I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Back in the early to mid-20th century, radio and newspapers were king. And like today, there were complaints about excessive commercialism, the lack of attention to public service, and the domination of powerful media companies and owners. In the 1940s, activists and government officials through the Federal Communications Commission worked together to try to bring about reform. Our guest Victor Picard writes about how these heroic efforts ultimately failed and the lessons for today's media landscape that, of course, includes television and the Internet. His book is called America's Battle for Media Democracy, and he's an assistant professor in the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia. And Victor Picard, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I often think of today as like the best of times and the worst of times. How do you think of it when it comes to the media?
Oh, I think that's a fair assessment. But of course, the tendency is to often assume that we've never been here before. We've never faced such a crisis before. These are all new problems and that we're dealing with new media. And so what I try to do in my book is to show some historical context for contemporary concerns about our media system.
Well, as I said in my intro, which is really drawn from your book, back in the 20th century, radio, newspaper, they were the kings. I mean, they called the shots when it came to news and media.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, commercial radio was roughly the same age as the Internet today. So it was still kind of a newish media in the 1940s. And society in general, policymakers in particular, had to try to figure out what is the role of this media in a democratic society.
Well, we think of FDR and his fireside chats on the radio, right?
That's right.
There's not to be too radio-centric here. But
it's true, and there's actually a picture of one of those iconic images on the cover of my book, and I think it sort of captures the centrality of these media institutions and the relationships between political elites and these media companies.
What I found interesting is that there was a lot of citizen complaint about, for instance, the commercialism of radio. You even talk about these listening councils where people would listen to the radio and then they could list their complaints about what they heard.
That's right. That was one of the surprises that the archives held for me in my research, which was even though this was supposedly the golden age of radio, and yet I found tremendous dissent, these complaints, critical letters written to the FCC, for example, that really sort of documented an alternative view and, as you suggest, these concerns about the over-commercialization of radio.
And this was across the country or certain parts of the country where people organized essentially what, to sit around their radios and listen?
That's right. I actually found evidence for this across the country in rural areas and cities. These radio listener councils were popping up, many social movement groups. And this is one of the interesting ironies that even in the mid-40s when you had a lot of New Deal activism in various stages of retreat throughout much of government, these social movement groups, civil rights groups, labor unions, apparently they hadn't gotten the memo that the period of reform had ended and there was actually a surge in activism. And these activists realized that in order to advance their issues, they had to deal with this commercial media system, radio in particular, and they had to change it. And to do so, they had to engage with media policy debates.
And there were, of course, these very powerful newspaper media owners, Hearst and others, that so dominated the news coverage.
Yes, they dominated a lot of news discourse. And what was interesting is that this phrase, the liberal media, was not in circulation at that time. Most people understood that the press was very rabidly anti-New Deal. They were, if anything, a conservative force in society. And FDR had a very antagonistic relationship with many of the big publishers.
Where did the FCC come from, the Federal Communications Commission?
So the FCC, which importantly does not regulate newspapers, of course, but does regulate broadcast media. The FCC, Federal Communications Commission, was founded in 1934 with the 1934 Communications Act. And essentially they were given regulatory oversight over much of our media system, broadcast media, telecommunications as well, which is why around a lot of today's Internet-related policy decisions, the FCC is very central to those debates.
You talk about some pretty important people, and it's funny, people don't think about the FCC or don't even know how to think about the FCC probably today and probably then as well. A guy named Larry Fly, who seemed to be a very important member of the FCC.
Yes, James Lawrence Fly, better known as Larry Fly. So another one of these ironies, even though the New Deal agenda was sort of withering throughout government, it arrived later and stayed longer at the FCC compared to other areas of government. And it really arrived with Larry Fly, who has been described as this tough Texan liberal, which is a phrase you don't hear very often today. But he was a veteran from 1930s battles with New Deal government. He had taken on a lot of monopolies and industries. And he arrived at the FCC as chair in the late 30s, early 40s. One of the first things he did was go after radio monopolies, and that sort of set off this flurry of progressive initiatives at the FCC.
He opposed things like media concentration. He also opposed, as you write, government wiretapping.
That's right. He did. That was one of the issues he was concerned about, even more so than FDR at the time. But he, even though FDR had sort of tasked him with going after radio monopolies, FDR was most concerned about newspapers, which again were very anti-New Deal, and they were buying up radio stations quite rapidly. So I think FDR would have preferred that Larry focus more on that policy problem, but instead Larry Fly went after these radio monopolies, NBC, CBS. He took what had been a languishing report on the radio industry, later became known as the Monopoly Report, and this very aggressive study of lack of competition in radio markets led to something that's quite unthinkable for us today. The FCC essentially trust-busted NBC, forced them to divest themselves one of their major networks, which then later became ABC. So that's how we ended up with the three big networks instead of the two at the time.
I mean, it's interesting to think of people then serving on the FCC, and then you've got these listening groups, as you said, organized, you know, labor. You've got perhaps civil rights group. So you have the sort of bottom and the top working in concert.
That's right. So there was this activism from above and below, and it was kind of a perfect storm. Sometimes historians refer to these moments as critical junctures, where you had political, social, technological change all happening at the same time, and it created this opening, this window for innovation, even radical ideas, ideas that would not be permissible in more normal times.
You talk about something called the Blue Book episode. What was the Blue Book?
The Blue Book, so named because of its blue cover, was the public service responsibilities for broadcast licensees. And essentially what happened after Larry Fly had led this very aggressive anti-monopoly campaign at the FCC, they were faced with the dilemma that even though they now had three big operators in radio instead of the two, it hadn't really transformed programming as much as they had liked. And another progressive FCC commissioner, Clifford Durr, and I should mention something rare that's probably hasn't happened since, was that there was a progressive block, a critical mass of progressive commissioners at the FCC at this time. Clifford Durr sort of picked up the baton where Larry Fly had left it off, and he wanted to focus more on programming. He saw a potential leverage point where for broadcasters to renew their licenses, they would have to satisfy certain public interest obligations. And that's what the Blue Book essentially set out to do.
You include a letter that was written by a guy named William Timus. He was an African-American World War II veteran. I just want to quote a couple of lines from what he said. And I guess he was complaining about the radio program. He comes back to the U.S. and hears things on the radio that really offends him. And he says, on the battlefields of France, on Okinawa, on Iwo Jima, we fought the devils of fascism, discrimination, hate, prejudice, and Jim Crow. We won that fight. We have come home to find that these enemies are very much alive here. It's too often the practice of vehicles of American propaganda, such as the movie industry and the radio, to depict the American Negro as a buffoon, lazy, shiftless, superstitious, ignorant, loose, and servile. This is not the democratic way of life for which so many of our fallen comrades paid so dearly with their lives. This is the Hitler pattern. This is American fascism. That's a really powerful statement or letter that he sent.
Yes, very powerful. And I think it represents a number of things. I mean, one, it's true at this time you had a lot of returning World War II veterans who had been exposed to different kinds of radio overseas. African Americans in particular at this time were very enraged with a lot of the programming. You had shows like Amos and Andy, which we still – many people recall today, which was a pair of white men who would speak in very caricatured – racist African-American dialect on the air. And of course, when they went to television, they would wear blackface. So this was something that understandably African-Americans were very upset about. And I think that it's fair to say that the FCC was feeling these pressures, these social pressures to do something. There was a lot of disgust about excessive advertising on the air. And so the Blue Book was their attempt to address this, to really try to create meaningful public interest obligations, a socially responsible media system, and with the assumption that if it didn't, broadcasters may lose their licenses, which is another sort of unthinkable notion today.
But did it take Amos and Andy off the air? I mean, was it that?
It did not. And to be fair, it probably never could have necessarily. But what it did try to do was to mandate segments of programming to things like public affairs, local culture, educational content, also to have segments that were non-commercial. Of course, this is before we had NPR and PBS, but it was trying to build in a non-commercial segment or pocket within the broader commercial system. It was very clear that it was trying to take out excessive advertising.
I mean, how much under those – and we'll be talking about the current day, but under those conditions – was the FCC in a position to essentially call the shots, to tell radio stations you can do this but you can't do that, or perhaps saying if you do this, you need to also do that?
I think more of the latter. It sort of sketched these broad parameters for, you know, what kind of programming are you giving to local communities. And it was based on this assumption that they are monopolizing the public airwaves. So this is a kind of social contract, this question of what do these commercial broadcasters owe the public in return for these tremendous benefits? They are profiting handsomely from using this public resource. And it was really – I mean, at the time, some people thought it was a very reasonable, fairly innocuous – I mean, they weren't completely decommercializing the medium. But, of course, I think this is what commercial broadcasters feared might eventually happen.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Victor Picard is our guest on Radio Times, and we're talking about his new book. It's called America's Battle for Media Democracy, and it's subtitled The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. He goes back to the 1940s and a number of decisions by the FCC to bring about reform. In many ways, those efforts were unsuccessful, but it does kind of lay the stage or set the stage for our media landscape today. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. How do we get to our media environment today? Well, our guest Victor Picard says perhaps if we look back at the 1940s, we can learn some things about some of the challenges facing not just the media, but also consumers as well. He's an assistant professor in the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, and again, author of a book called America's Battle for Media Democracy, co-edited a book back in 2011 called Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? I do want to talk about the fairness doctrine, but you, I think, rightly suggested we need to talk just a bit about red baiting, because that's helpful in understanding, I guess, the segue between the Blue Book and the fairness doctrine.
Yes, I think that's a good place to start historically, because, again, there was this rare window in the mid-40s for the potential for significant reforms, especially in our media system. And what happened quickly after this Blue Book was issued was – industry representatives in particular pounced on it and treated it as a a life and death matter, essentially. And they did so by red baiting it, and that essentially saying that this was part of a socialist plot. And of course, this was right when the communist anti-communist hysteria was beginning to dramatically shift the political landscape. And the FCC was really taken by surprise and never really had a chance to fully recover from this onslaught. Ultimately, the even though the FCC was sort of the last stand of for the New Deal agenda, ultimately these reformers were chased out of D.C. by these red-baiting efforts. By the late 40s, they had basically been pushed out. But the Fairness Doctrine was the last battle that happened at the end of that decade for media reform.
And just for – I mean, it does get invoked today, but essentially it's not in existence today. But where did the Fairness then Doctrine come from, and what was it about?
Sure. So after the broadcasters were able to defeat the Blue Book initiative, they turned their sights on what had been called the Mayflower Doctrine, which was passed in 1941 when Larry Fly was still the chair at the FCC. The Mayflower Doctrine basically prohibited broadcasters from politically editorializing. It assumed that, especially given this kind of monopolistic landscape, giving them that kind of megaphone would be too much political power in a democratic society. So they overturned the Mayflower rule. And what took its place was the eventually what became known as the Fairness Doctrine.
Which is that it's important to cover what controversial issues, and you need to present, if not differing point of views, well, certainly contrasting point of views.
That's right. So today it's often misunderstood. People conflate it with the equal time rule, this idea that you just need to present two sides to a debate. But it was much more progressive than that. It assumed that broadcasters had to go into local communities, find out what were the important issues, and as you say, cover them in a balanced manner. But that meant by including diverse voices and viewpoints. So it was this affirmative duty that broadcasters had to satisfy to keep their licenses.
So why was it repealed in the late 80s?
So another interesting historical irony, even though today it's often held up, especially by progressives, as this high watermark for progressive media policy, in 1949, when it was initially passed, it was seen as a kind of consolation prize for a more structural, strict regulation. Reformers were not at all happy with it. But that said, it did take on a life of its own. It did have unintended consequences, and activists on the left and the right used it with various levels of success for the ensuing decades until you get to the mid-1980s during the Reagan administration. And Mark Fowler, who was the chair of the FCC that time, who famously, perhaps infamously, said that television was nothing more than a toaster with pictures, which gives you a sense of his idea about what media is. Essentially, it's a widget. It's a commodity. He was the one who ultimately revoked it in 1987. But interestingly, even at that time, you had then Representative Newt Gingrich and other leading conservatives who wanted to legislate it, who were very much in support of the Fairness Doctrine. Again, right-wing activists relied on it as well as a tool with which they could pressure broadcasters to expand the parameters of the debates, of coverage of important issues.
And I do want to get to present day. One other, I guess, important thing that happens in the 1940s is something you call the Hutchins Commission.
Yes.
They were convened to do what?
Yes. So another forgotten chapter from our history. But essentially, the Hutchins Commission was made up of an A-team of American intellectuals. It was led by Robert Hutchins, who was the president of the University of Chicago. He happened to be college buddies with Henry Luce, who was a big publisher of Time Life magazines, and certainly was not known to be a big progressive on these issues. Another irony, but he funded this commission, which was meant to figure out the responsibilities of the press and basically determine what freedom of the press means in American society. And I think the resolutions of those debates grappling with these big normative questions continue to affect and shape the parameters around some of these future journalism debates today.
Did they have some kind of report where they came up with a sort of a list of criteria or values?
Absolutely. So this is where the social responsibility model of the press comes from. And Interestingly, there was this main report. They actually issued six reports, but there was a main general report that everyone focused on, and it was very watered down. If you look at the unpublished transcripts, which I did for my book research, you found that they were considering much more structural alternatives, subsidizing the press, creating startups, new startups in one newspaper towns. Because at this time in the 40s, there was a newspaper industry crisis with some similarities to the one that we're facing today. There was fears of the rise of one newspaper towns, the loss of community newspapers, newspaper monopolies in general. And so they were trying to come up with these structural alternatives. Should we use antitrust to break them up, to break up the chains? And in the end, they came down on fairly, I would suggest, halfway measures, compromises. Even so, ironically, they were pounced on and they were red-baited, similarly as the Blue Book had been red-baited. They were seen as being part of this communist attempt, especially the McCormick of the Chicago Tribune basically went to war with the Hutchins Commission and thought they were somehow in cahoots with the UN effort. And so there was
the Trilateral Commission
vaguely conspiratorial. So even though it had come out fairly innocuous, it was pounced on. The press either attacked it or ignored it, and yet still we came eventually what we refer to as the social responsibility model of the press can be traced back to these debates around the Hutchins Commission.
Do you then see parallels between these struggles in the 1940s to deal with things like commercialism and ownership and content and what is going on today?
Very much so. I think there are a lot of parallels, a lot of lessons we can draw, cautionary tales. I try not to overstate those parallels. Oftentimes, under fierce scrutiny, they fall apart. But I do think that we can learn a lot, that this is a usable history that can instruct some of our current debates, especially because these roads not taken have been so much forgotten in our contemporary discourse.
I mean, we talk about the public airwaves, but they really aren't public.
They are. I mean, it sounds like a slogan, but it still belongs to the public. That slogan, the air belongs to the people, was kind of a rallying cry for the 1940s media reform movement, and it's still very much true today.
I mean, that the rallying cry may be true, but do you think the airwaves really are public?
Well, that's open for debate. I mean, certainly it was a kind of public trustee model that a lot of the FCC policy was based on, and this idea that broadcasters were leasing the public airwaves and they were returning these public interest obligations, performing them for society in general. Whether that contract is still holding together is a very open question.
In fact, we have an email from Drew. Where did the notion of the airwaves being a public asset come from, and how analogous is this to the origins of internet infrastructure and the implications for net neutrality? I mean, that's where we could spend the next half hour talking about all of that. But
it's an excellent question. So there are certainly technical differences. The internet does not rely nearly as much, if at all. Excuse me, unless. Of course, wireless internet still does to some extent, but it's not relying on the public airwaves in the same way that broadcast media does and or continues to. So I think that even though there are these differences, you still could argue that these are vital media infrastructures and they are essentially public goods. So they are things that society requires, but the market does not always produce in a sufficient way. And that's where there's a necessary role for policy intervention to make sure that the public is being served by these media communication infrastructures.
What would that intervention look like?
Well, today, and I don't know if we want to start talking about net neutrality.
Why not?
but that would be probably Exhibit A for where the FCC, certainly many people would argue, it looks like they probably will intervene to mandate particular public interest protections. And probably should define net neutrality. It's a deceptively technical, wonky term that we're unfortunately stuck with. But it's this very straightforward safeguard that's been in existence for many years, which is that all content online should be treated equally, that your internet service provider, whether it's Comcast or Verizon, should not be able to interfere with your online content, that they should not be able to block it or slow it down.
I mean, just as simple as that.
It really is that basic, and obviously would affect our daily lives and how we interface with the internet without net neutrality protections.
That's Victor Picard, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about the media, and in fact, he's the author of a new book called America's Battle for Media Democracy, looking back at the 1940s, finding some interesting parallels to today. It's subtitled The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. He's an assistant professor in the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia. We've got a bunch of emails here. Also, you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. What do you mean by corporate libertarianism? I'm sure some people are scratching their heads about that.
Yes, that question comes up. Those are two words you rarely see paired together. But what I'm trying to get at with that phrase is this formation, this ideological formation that really crystallized in the 40s, which assumed that corporations, media corporations specifically, have individual rights. Specifically, they have First Amendment rights, and that their rights often trump or often privileged over the rights of the public, over local communities, society writ large. And in addition to that, there's often an assumption that these corporations should be self-regulated, that there really isn't a legitimate role for a very small role for governmental oversight.
You also say, and I mean, if the future is the internet or is digital, I mean, it certainly looks like it's going that way. At least as it stands today, about a third of households in this country do not have broadband internet.
That's right. Yes,
yeah,
it's shocking.
It leaves this entire swath of people out of the news.
Yes, yes. I mean, the digital divide sounds like something from the 90s, but it's still very much in effect today, and it really disenfranchises a lot of people. The internet's no longer a luxury. It's a necessity for all Americans. And I think there is a shift in the discourse right now that's recognizing it as a vital utility, something like electricity, that we're just going to have to make sure that all Americans have access to. But our media policy has not caught up to that reality yet. And there are many political forces that are working against it.
I mean, the idea of sort of back like they did in under the New Deal, which is to make sure everyone had electricity. You're saying something equivalent to that for broadband.
That's right, yes. And I think that sort of New Deal idea is kind of social democratic idea is still very much in effect, or at least it's trying to become actualized in today's media policy debates, these continuing battles.
You think newspapers are going to go away as we know them, as perhaps gets delivered at people's doorsteps?
I think, unfortunately, tragically, yes. All signs point to that ultimate outcome. It's a question of when. And it's not going to be the sudden change that maybe we had feared back in 2008, 2009. Instead, it's going to be this slow bleed, this gradual erosion. Unfortunately, I don't think we're ever going to hear the alarm bells that are probably required now to really try to change course.
And what is lost? If we lose newspapers as we know them, what is lost?
Sure. So reasonable people disagree on this question, but I think it's fair to say that a lot of the journalism, at least the ideal form of journalism, the public service journalism, will be lost. We already know that journalism that covers, for example, state houses, local reporting, international reporting, the kinds of reporting that cost a lot of money and don't often have an immediate profitable return, these are the kinds that are withering away. And, of course, those are the types of journalism that democracy depends on the most.
And what, we're left with people just arguing with each other in TV studios?
Oftentimes. Of course, we will have public radio. We will have bastions of democratic discourse. But I'm concerned that even though on the surface it seems like there are all these voices, much of it does amount to so much commentary.
Well, this almost goes without saying, but if you, for instance, over the weekend I was Googling, the Charlie Hebdo crisis tragedy in Paris. I was able to read commentary news reports from all over the world sitting in my chair in my little study.
That's right. I mean,
it's a wonderful thing.
It is a wonderful thing, and it would be foolish to dismiss that. We do have access, or at least those of us who have internet access have access to more voices than ever before. Right. But at the same time, I think that's also a reason I think you're demonstrating the importance of having journalistic institutions. And even much of the commentary that takes place through social media can be traced back to these legacy media that are still producing the hard news. So I think as a democratic society, we still require that information source, and we have to find a way to support it.
But does that have to be a newspaper? I mean, that sort of original source, does it need to be a newspaper?
Well, we always have to tease apart the nostalgia here. So I don't think it has to be the kind of dead tree variety that leaves our fingers ink stained, as much as we, myself included, really adore, really cherish that form of news media. But it's going to be a digital media, and yet when you move to a digital environment, the economics change. So we have to find a way to support that digital media.
And we're almost having a break here, but I mean, newspapers struggled to pay their bills, but the internet has perhaps a different kind of struggle, but is also trying to figure out how to pay its bills.
That is true.
These news outlets online.
Oh, that is true. And as advertisers and readers migrate to the web, it changes the economics dramatically. We know that online advertising pays pennies to the dollar that the traditional advertising paid to be placed in broadsheets. So this is this changes everything structurally, and we need to figure out. Some newspapers are using paywalls. There are different models so far. They're mixed success at best.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again, talking with Victor Picard. And he's got a new book. It's called America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. Again, he's an assistant professor in the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. And we do have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at whyy. Radio Times, and we'll be reading and taking some more comments and questions right after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. As we all know, newspapers are struggling with circulation and struggling to pay their debts. A number of them are folding or have folded. New online news media outlets haven't always found ways to make revenue as well. And we are talking about the state of media with our guest, Victor Picard. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Victor, I wonder with the internet, we've sort of gotten in the habit of just getting stuff for free there. I mean, that was the original idea, was that it would be a place where things were for free. It was for all of us.
Yes. So these new economics with the internet have sort of laid bare what had been disguised for many years about the economic relationship between advertising and news media. And so for 125 years, in the case of newspapers, often very lucrative business where advertisers paid newspaper owners to reach their reading audiences. And in many ways, you could say that the news was kind of a positive externality of this relationship. And it worked fairly well, varying degrees of success for many years. But now that advertising no longer pays and that business model has fallen apart, we're suddenly realizing that someone has to pay for news. News has never paid for itself. It's always been a very expensive endeavor, always been subsidized in some way. But before, where it was advertisers, today we're trying to scramble to find a new revenue source.
Well, that's where these millionaires and billionaires come in, right? Trying to create the New Republic and some other organizations as well. Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, First Look Media. Can we rely on rich benefactors to keep media democracy alive?
I wish that we could. So I refer to this as the benevolent billionaire model for saving journalism. And unfortunately, billionaires are not always benevolent, or at least they don't always have democratic society's interests in mind. They often have their own interests. And I think often what we're seeing is that, I mean, it's a case-by-case situation, but in many cases, we realize we can't rely on this as a systemic approach to saving journalism. It might save a news outlet here and there, and wherever it does, I guess we should embrace that. But in many cases, it's not going to. And you're going to run into problems, as you did with the New Republic or with Matt Taibbi at First Look.
Where you've got really enterprising reporters who sort of just say, I'm not doing this, right?
That's right. I mean, sometimes it comes down to personality conflicts. I think oftentimes it comes down to a different approach, just whether you're considering journalism as a kind of public trust, public service, or whether you've seen it as an instrumentalist thing, you know, becoming sort of a plaything for these billionaires. It's serving different objectives. And I think that's often what's being debated here.
One thing I just wanted to comment on, then we'll get to our callers and some more email comments as well. But you do remind us the early development of the internet was dependent on state subsidies via military and research institutions. That we should acknowledge its beginnings.
Yes, the internet certainly was heavily publicly subsidized, as was our postal system. Is a great example of a relatively socialistic enterprise. I mean, it was meant to be subsidized by government. And of course, the postal system started out as a newspaper delivery system. So it was kind of like the internet of the 1800s. And it was not that controversial that government would subsidize it, that it wouldn't necessarily pay for itself.
Let me get, looks like Phil from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Mm-hmm. Hi, Phil, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
I have a question about public radio.
Sure.
I'm wondering about the place of corporate libertarianism in public radio. And I'm thinking about the effects of the loss of federal funding for stations like WHYY, who have, at least on my view, come to rely increasingly on corporate funding. And I'm wondering what the author thinks about what the implications might be for control and for content on public radio stations.
Phil, I just have a quick question here for you. Are you a member of WHYY?
Yes.
You are. Okay.
No.
The reason I ask is that we get about half of our money from listeners. Sounds like I'm doing a pitch here on the radio, and get a variety of money from a little bit from the federal government, some obviously from underwriters and from corporations as well. So I just wanted to acknowledge we get about half of our money from our listeners. But it is a model that has its critics, Victor.
Yes. I think the caller is raising a very important question. There's grounds for legitimate concern that there is this gradual corporate encroachment on our public media system in general as we defund it, or we don't fund it adequately. And I think to put this in a sort of a bigger picture perspective, compared to other democratic societies, America is off the charts in how little it pays for its public media system. Per capita per year, we pay something around $1.50, where in Britain that would be closer to $100, in Scandinavian countries, $200. So I think that I wouldn't blame public media outlets for being forced to look elsewhere for money to their individual listeners and viewers as well. I think ideally we would be supporting them more adequately.
Phil, I appreciate the call. I appreciate your support as well. And just to make another little note, about 10% of people who listen are members. And that's, I think, in a sense, part of the problem. Mm-hmm. Let me get Rick from Warminster to join us. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I think I've gone through the evolution of what your guest has described myself. I used to be the spokesman for the Pentagon, then spokesman for the Olympics in Atlanta, and spokesman in the corporate world. So I've had a chance to deal with the media firsthand. And then additionally, I've had the editor of a newspaper and a magazine. So I know about the 60-40 relationship where advertising, you know, takes up 60%, 40% is news or whatever. I think ultimately, as the evolution continues, radio will still maintain its personal relationship. It's a one-on-one relationship, kind of like Play Misty for me with Clint Eastwood. But I think ultimately newspapers will go, and I think magazines will stay for the special interest audience that they try and resonate with. But the news itself, I think, has, you know, deteriorated into entertainment, and the people who are simply readers are now trying to do analysis for us.
Well, that's a very interesting commentary, Rick. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. But the question is, should we be concerned about this? Is this a cause for sort of a society level discussion? Some people would describe it as democratizing the news, but I would be concerned that actual journalism and news production is not happening at adequate levels for democratic society.
So how do we fix that?
Well, I, through my research, come down on the notion that we will have to find a way to subsidize news production. They can be indirect and yet targeted subsidies. Certainly, we would make sure that the government does not have any control over content or viewpoint of the media. But I do think that at least thus far, we're not seeing ways where the market left to itself will just naturally support news.
In fact, you say that the market model really has failed.
In many ways.
I mean, it doesn't work.
Yeah, there is an economic term for this market failure, which also takes into consideration what you described earlier, that only 10% of your listeners actually will support the media that they're listening to. There's a free rider problem as well. So it's the market, but it's also an audience problem. But together, we as a society, we'll have to decide that this is something we need to have, regardless of whether it's profitable or not.
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. An email from PJ. How many worked as radio journalists in the 40s, 50s compared to now? He probably won't know, but can guess after WHY and KYW. I'm guessing there are only a handful of journalists working. Very few newscasts after Morning Rush, and many of the news are there just for laughs and not local, blah, 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 blah. It goes on from there. I mean, it's interesting sort of who calls themselves a journalist today. You know, I mean, they're people that opine and have opinions and they blog, often calling themselves journalists and often acting as journalists.
Yes, and this is always a thorny question, yeah. One that I usually try to sidestep to some degree. But
you're in my headlights.
That's
here,
right.
So.
But I think at the very least we can look at what's happened in just the last 10 years. We've seen a decline of somewhere between 30 and 35% of professional journalists, news workers. So whether bloggers and various sometimes called para-journalists who are taking on some of those attributes, but yet they're not being paid. In many cases, they're not being paid to do so. They're sort of volunteerist, and I think this is problematic. As much as I applaud those practices and like to see more of it, I think we need to make it something that people could be paid to do and have benefits and health care and things like that. So ideally in a democratic society, we'd provide for that.
But would that be sort of government supported? I mean, the way we have a military, we'd have a media.
Perhaps in an ideal society. Of course, I don't see that happening anytime soon. But at the very least, if we could find ways to expand that $1.50 per capita, if we also could pass new tax laws to help struggling newspapers transition into nonprofit or low profit status, this would be another way. I also argue in the conclusion of my book that we could try to leverage existing public infrastructure like post offices and public libraries and try to create for local journalism to try to create this local community media infrastructure.
I mean, there is this thing called hyper-local. In fact, Newsworks, WHYY, has done some of that, which is very very targeted, focused coverage of small neighborhoods, people caring about what happens within their borders.
Yes, and oftentimes this kind of journalism is not profitable because on any given day, not a whole lot's happening in your backyard. But when something does happen, ideally you would have journalists on the beat who would be able to cover it, interpret what's happening, let community members know what's at stake. And that's exactly the kind of journalism that we're no longer able to support.
We have another email. This is Mike. This is he says there's a terrible information bottleneck on the web where unlimited access to different publications still requires individual subscriptions, same as before the web. When will a Jeff Bezos negotiate with the media to broker pay as you read online?
Yeah, that's sometimes referred to as the iTunes model of journalism. And it was really big in 2008, 2009, a lot of buzz around that. I don't think it's a viable option. I mean, for one thing, you don't keep listening. You don't keep reading the same stories. I'm not sure what the business model would be there. But it's a great mm-hmm. it's a great idea.
It sure is. Let me see what Carol from Ridley Park has to say. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi. Good
hi
morning.
There.
Thanks
good morning.
For taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, listen, I was just wondering because you sort of touched on it, but my question had to do with now that there is, you know, a decline in newspapers and there's less and less reporting on state, municipal, county, school board type of meetings, things, et cetera, and with that lack of somebody investigating and or at least monitoring and reporting on these things, it seems to leave the ground wide open in that since nobody's watching and nobody's kind of reporting, it just leaves the whole thing ripe for all kinds of corruption.
Well, that's the watchdog job of the media, Victor.
That's right. That is the concern.
You don't have it covering, you know, at a local level, at a, you know, like you used to have somebody say cover the school board meeting, and that particular group knew what went on at the school
sure.
board meeting.
But sure.
Yes, it creates a lot of potential for mischief of various kinds, state and corporate malfeasance. And I don't think our media system was doing a perfect job before covering those in power. But certainly we need more of that, not less of it. And unfortunately, that is what's happening. People in power are relieved by the situation, but the rest of us are not benefiting from it.
I sometimes get depressed. We do shows about things like what's happening in your local or state government, and we get almost no response from anybody. I'll be completely honest. And we take some more sort of sexy, you know, controversial topic, and we do something like that, and we get inundated with response, and it's trying to sort of figure out our various responsibilities and what does the audience actually want.
Yes, and there's always going to be a tension there, but of course a media system that's under tremendous profit pressures, commercial pressures, they're going to increasingly move towards that former concern about we have to entertain people and just give people that sort of lifestyle news coverage, when ideally in a democratic society, we need to be – even if it's not as sexy, we need to hear about the state of our infrastructure, for example, the state of our bridges and railways and things that don't necessarily sell advertising, but we still need to know as a democratic society.
And do we need a new or a more invigorated Federal Communications Commission, FCC?
I think so. And of course, again, the FCC doesn't have direct purview over newspapers, but increasingly in this digital world, the conduit and the content are merging. So if we assume that the future of journalism is a digital one, we're also going to have to be talking about net policies like net neutrality in the same, if not the same sentence, the same paragraph as we talk about the future of journalism.
And it seems we're almost out of time here, but it seems President Obama kind of indicated late last year, that he is in support of net neutrality. I don't know. I mean, sometimes it's hard to read the tea leaves.
Yes, this was kind of an FDR moment where Obama really came out and intervened in this debate, and that didn't just intervene, but sort of educated the public about what was at stake and what we needed to do. And he basically supported the strongest measure of net neutrality protection, which that, along with the nearly 4 million people who wrote into the FCC, by some estimates, 99% of which were in support of net neutrality, I think this shifted the debate. And we'll know on February 26th, but it looks like Tom Wheeler, the chair of the FCC, is now he's indicated he's going to go with the President Obama's plan for a very strong, meaningful net neutrality protection.
On that note, Victor Picard, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, the book is called America's Battle for Media Democracy, and he's an assistant professor in the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to iTunes to download a podcast of the show. Also go to our homepage, whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.